At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Congratulations, you made it. The holiday weekend is here. But the Senate was in no rush to finish up its work today before lawmakers got out of town, which gives people who depend on jobless benefits some reason to worry. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Happy Friday, this 28th of May. It's been 2 years since Congress started pushing jobless benefits beyond their expiration limits at the state level, and there are now more than 10 million people nationwide getting unemployment checks. With those federal subsidies, the maximum they're supposed to keep getting a check is 99 weeks. But since Congress hasn't piled on more cash, people could start running out of benefits before time's up. Today, the House passed a bill to extend benefits through November, but the Senate left town without doing anything. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joins us to explain. Hello, Mitchell.
Hi, Bob.
So where does this all stand now?
Well, the House finally passed a funding bill today, but Democrats, those blue dog Democrats who were worried about the deficit, were busy all week stripping out items to get the price tag down. That included federal subsidies to help unemployed people keep paying for health insurance. But now with the Senate on recess and not back until June 7th, basically nothing more can happen until then at the earliest. And by mid-June, we're already going to have seen 300,000 people run out of unemployment benefits.
Now, certainly this disagreement is about the deficit, the cost of extending these benefits again and again. But isn't it also partly about whether longer benefits are really good for the economy and good for the unemployed, for that matter?
Well, if you ask unemployed people, there's no doubt that extended unemployment benefits are good for them. I mean, it's good for their bank account at the very least. But there is an argument that extending unemployment benefits actually makes the unemployment rate go up and it keeps people unemployed for longer. Robert Shimer is at the University of Chicago. That's one of those bastions of free market economics where this argument holds a pretty lot of weight.
There's quite strong evidence that people either hold out for higher wages or maybe look a little less hard, or they look for jobs which are closer to home or more of the type of job that they would like to get when unemployment benefits are more generous or last for longer.
And Shimer says that's probably actually inflating the unemployment rate maybe as much as 1.5%. So let's say we'd be at 8.5% unemployment instead of nearly 10% unemployment.
Now, I'm assuming that view isn't universal, though.
Well, No, although actually most economists will agree that better and longer unemployment benefits do let people hold out for a better and maybe a higher paying job. In fact, that's partly what those unemployment benefits are there for. But, you know, that doesn't mean that if people went off unemployment sooner, they'd just be able to get off their butts, go out and find a job. I've talked to a lot of unemployed people and, you know, their response is, well, what job? Keep in mind, there's more than five job seekers right now for every available job. Competition for those jobs is just brutal. Nearly half the unemployed have been looking for more than 6 months, and it's taking longer than ever to find a job.
But let's say people are more desperate, just applying for and grabbing whatever job they can land. Wouldn't that at least get more people working again?
Well, you know, you might see the unemployment rate actually go down some. Certainly, it seems likely that wages would go down because suddenly you've got more people willing to work for anything they can get, even minimum wage. You know, maybe also employers wouldn't offer as many benefits because they wouldn't have to. There's another impact, though, if you cut off these extended benefits. Gary Bertlis at the Brookings Institution explained this to me.
All of these workers who are receiving unemployment benefits would have to cut their consumption spending, and so the money that is made available to them through extended benefits is also helping to boost consumption or at least hold it up to a higher level than it would have been if we had not helped these long-term unemployed.
And, you know, that's probably about to happen, at least if Congress doesn't come back and extend benefits again in June. That consumption, that stimulative effect of the extended unemployment benefits is probably going to start going away.
Well, this is a story we're going to have to come back to. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, thank you.
You're welcome.
A disappointing cap to a discouraging month on Wall Street. The details when we do the numbers. A regulatory filing from BP today tallies its costs in responding to the big Gulf oil spill at close to $1 billion. President Obama toured the region today and promised to do whatever it takes.
You will not be abandoned. You will not be left behind. The cameras at some point may leave. The media may get tired of the story. But we will not.
To be precise, BP figures it spent $930 million so far on cleanup and prevention work and paying grants to states along the Gulf Coast. Just a few months after General Motors heaved Saturn out of orbit, along with a couple of other less popular brands, Ford reportedly thinks Mercury has too much gravitational pull on its earnings. Sales of that brand are down 74% over the last decade. So Mercury seems headed for what's become the auto industry's black hole. Marketplace's Brett Neely has the story.
The last time Mercury may have been a sexy car brand was when James Dean drove one in the 1955 classic Rebel Without a Cause. And like Dean's tortured teenage character, the brand suffers from an identity crisis. John Wolkanowicz is a senior auto analyst at IHS Global Insight and an amateur car historian.
When Mercury was introduced in 1939, it was to place a middle car in between Ford and Lincoln. Ford was the common man's car. Lincoln was the premium car.
That strategy used to work, he says. But over time, the cars became less distinctive until Mercury's became nothing more than super Fords. A Ford spokesman said the company has no announcements about Mercury at this time. And some Mercury dealers I spoke to weren't worried. Alan Frisch owns a dealership in suburban Chicago.
So far, they've always been upfront and fair with us, and I've been a dealer for 25 years, so if they say that they're going to take care of us, I'm not really worried about it.
But another dealer told me that Ford is trying to kill the brand. He said the company's making it harder to get new cars for his lot and has offered to buy out his franchise. Detroit car companies have been busy shedding their worst-performing brands for years. In some ways, the bigger surprise to auto analyst John Wolkanowicz is that it took this long for Mercury to get the axe.
Who drives Mercury's these days?
I do.
You do?
But I'm an anomaly. I buy inexpensive used cars. Mercury's are a great buy because they don't hold their value well.
Bloomberg News, which broke the story, says Ford will decide Mercury's fate in July. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Its ads may claim otherwise, but Toys R Us is growing up. The big box toy seller revealed today it plans to become publicly traded. The initial public offering could raise up to $800 million. Of course, we've been here before. Private investors bought out shareholders 5 years ago when Walmart and Target started whipping Toys R Us on the playground. Now they're aiming to get their money back. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports it's a tricky time to be trying that.
If you're looking for a cool stock symbol for your portfolio, Toys R Us has a great one, TOYS. But if you're in it for the money, consider some other IPOs this spring. The clothing chain Express began selling its shares on the market 2 weeks ago. It's down 15%. Metals USA, down 27% from April.
We still think we're in the early stages of a recovery in the IPO space.
Paul Bard with Renaissance Capital says companies like Toys R Us, Neiman Marcus, and Dunkin' Donuts are in a tough spot. Their private owners have turned things around, but the volatile stock market makes it a risky time to complete the cycle, go public again.
These companies they've now been cleaned up. Their numbers are starting to look better with the recovery that's taking hold, and they need to recapitalize the business. They really need to offer investors a good incentive to buy in, and that means a very attractive price.
Bard thinks Toys R Us could reverse the trend of dismal IPOs. The toy store's profits are up 55%. The new owners brought in a Target executive as CEO. He closed more than 100 stores, opened as many new ones, and built up the company's online business. Toy industry consultant Richard Gottlieb says Toys R Us has made smart bets on hot toys, like stocking up on those Zuzu Pets hamster things. And it's got more variety.
When you go into a toy department at Walmart, you're not going to be surprised. You're going to find exactly what you saw advertised on television. But when you go in with Toys R Us, you're going to see some things maybe you never thought you'd see.
But shopping for toys is one thing. With an initial public offering, investors like to know what they're going to get. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
As some retirees know all too well, pension plan investments have been hurt by the financial crisis. It hasn't helped that high unemployment has cut contributions from employers. There's one type of pension plan favored by truckers and construction workers. It's been hit particularly hard. Lawmakers in Washington are considering limited government help. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports it could create a precedent for taxpayer bailouts of struggling pension plans.
Multi-employer pension plans pool contributions from several employers, allowing contract workers to carry their pension benefits with them as they move from job to job.
Many of the industries in which multi-employer plans are prevalent are hurting.
Eli Greenblum works on multi-employer plans for the American Academy of Actuaries. He says construction company bankruptcies and trucking industry deregulation have brought several multi-employer plans to the edge of insolvency.
Multi-employer plans do have limitations in terms of the way that they are funded. They're funded through collective bargaining agreements.
Multi-employer plans that go bankrupt have limited insurance from the Federal Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation. Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey, a Democrat, is proposing to make the corporation more responsible for the hardest-hit multi-employer plans. He says the cost to taxpayers would be limited to $8 billion.
Our bill is really focused on providing some short-term relief that will help. In this case, one plan in particular covers 2,000 employers and hundreds of thousands of workers.
But at a hearing on the Casey plan yesterday, Wyoming Republican Senator Michael Enzi said it sets a bad precedent.
This is extremely dangerous, and I strongly believe that if this provision passes, then it'll be the taxpayer who will eventually be bailing out the PBGC.
This debate is only tinkering at the edges of a much larger problem. A study last year found the long-term shortfall in multi-employer pension plans will be around $165 billion. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
After the month we've had in the stock market, overseas, and on the Gulf, I'm sure most of us are ready for a long weekend. I know I am. But before we get to that, let's review where we've been in business. To do the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond, we have Felix Salmon from Reuters. Hi, Felix.
Hi.
And John Carney, senior editor at CNBC.
Hello.
Just to start off, signs point to this May being the worst for stocks in almost 40 years. After some plunges, though, we did pick up a little this week. So is this correction that everybody's been talking about over, John?
I think that there's still a lot of negativity in the markets. When I talk to hedge fund managers, they all say, oh, we're de-risking still. So there might be a little bit ways to go down some more, but I don't think much more.
Oh, I love this market speak. Felix, have we finished de-risking?
We're de-risking and hitting bottom. And it's all pretty meaningless stuff. The stock market goes up and the stock market goes down, and sometimes it's more volatile and sometimes it's less volatile. My feeling is that we're going to continue to see volatility so long as there's a lot of big question marks over the fate of Europe and the sovereigns and what's going on over there. And volatility can be up as well. I mean, we might well see the stock market go up by 1,000 points. So I'm not going to start predicting directions, but I am going to say that it's going to be up and down, rocky ride.
I wonder how much of this volatility comes from the thin trading volume, though. Have people just bailed out of the market, John, do you think?
Yes, people are bailing out of the market. In particular, I was at a hedge fund conference last week in Las Vegas, and they were all talking about wanting to have more liquid assets, more cash. So they are exiting a lot of trades that they thought were risky. I don't think mom and pops are bailing out of the market because I think the retail consumer bailed out a long time ago and never really came back.
Felix, your take?
I think people should bail out of the market. I think that the stock market is showing itself to be a very risky place to be invested. And for all of the risk that we can see, you're just not getting the requisite return.
I think Felix is absolutely right about that. You're safer investing your money in, you know, setting up a local bakery than putting it into the stock market these days.
Well, let's move on to how safe we are with the banks, given what they may be hiding in the back room. We heard this week that the organization that sets the rules for corporate accounting wants to make the banks come clean with investors about what their outstanding loans are really worth today and not just what they supposedly pay out over time. These days, the shortfall could be in the tens of billions of dollars. And Felix, what's the upside of giving this more prominence?
The upside is simply transparency. We want to know, as these are public companies with public shareholders, we own these banks, a lot of us. We want to know what their assets are. And if you're a bank, your assets are the loans that you've made to people. And what's more, if the banks do report this number, that would actually help in terms of risk management because they'd notice when their loans start going sour before the loans default, and they might be able to do something about it.
John, the banks say, look, when our loans reach maturity, they could very well still pay off.
Crossing your fingers and hoping isn't a very good risk management strategy, and that's exactly what they're doing when they say that.
And what about the argument that you can mislead investors in the other direction if you include this discounted number in the bottom line, and then the loans end up paying off, John?
Well, I mean, then you have some lucky investors who will be very happy with you. I do think that there's a chance that a lot of loans that get marked down will get marked back up. But the fact is that banks have been using that argument since 2007 when they first started to write down their assets, and they were wrong. We cannot have these guys say, well, look, we know better than the marketplace about what our loans are actually worth. Because we know they don't. They don't have a crystal ball that tells them which loans will pay off. What we have is a market process that evaluates how much these loans are worth. That's the only way to mark them, not to some model cooked up by a mathematical genius in the basement of Citigroup.
Felix Salmon from Reuters, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Carney, senior editor at CNBC, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, hospitals strive to bring on the customer love and higher insurance payouts through advertising.
Every business wants to be a must-have business, right? I mean, that's the essence of why we develop brands.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, why should the last day of the month be any different? The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 122 points, or 1 2/10%, to close at 10,136. The NASDAQ dropped 20 points, or 0.9%, to 2,257. The S&P 500 lost 13 points, that's 1.25%, to finish at 1,089. For the month, the Dow plummeted 7.9%. The NASDAQ lost 8.3%, and the S&P 500 fell 8.2%. Fitch Ratings knocked Spain down a notch, but analysts suggested the Eurozone debt troubles won't necessarily leapfrog to our side of the pond. Financials still struggle with Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Morgan Stanley all down 2% or more. BP spilled more than 5% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 3.28%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Of course, you traders out there know that U.S. markets are closed for Memorial Day. Things may be quiet for a minute at many events across the country where the National Moment of Remembrance is observed at 3 p.m. local time. And the World Health Organization focuses on women and smoking on World No Tobacco Day. The theme aims to call attention to marketing that targets women. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Got some extra change this holiday weekend? You might need it if you're stocking up for your big cookout. Beef prices are nudging up. Erica Aguilar reports from KUT in Austin, Texas, the largest beef-producing state in the country.
It's a classic tale of supply and demand. You're paying higher prices for steak because there just aren't enough cattle in the market these days. It started last year during a prolonged drought. Rancher Ken Persine is at the Lockhart Livestock Auction. The drought forced him to sell off some of his herd.
A lot of ranches liquidated their cattle, sold out because they didn't have anything to feed them. There was no grass. And right now they're rebuilding their herds now, buying and restocking.
Ranchers in the Midwest had to deal with the opposite weather. Cows braved a snowy, bitter winter. They burned up calories trying to stay warm and weighed less once they reached the slaughterhouse. Ranchers were also squeezed by high fuel and feed cost. Then there's always the economy to blame, says Russell Woodward. He's the product marketing manager at the Texas Beef Council.
As the weak dollar allows us to export more of those items, that means that our products are cheaper in those markets, so people will buy those versus other competing products. So that's picking up a little bit, causing us to have a little bit less here that we might typically have this time of year.
Ranchers and slaughterhouses are paying $100 to $200 more per cow. That leads to an extra 50 cents to a dollar per pound at the grocery store. Cattle consultant Leslie Callahan worries the high prices will entice ranchers to sell more female cows, the heifers.
Well, what is the heifers? The heifers is the factory that you have to keep to make more cows, to make more calves.
Callahan says since 1996, the number of cattle in the U.S. has dropped by at least 30%. And with the higher prices that have followed, he says consumers are now choosing less expensive cuts of beef. Fortunately for those grilling hamburgers this weekend, at least ground beef is cheap. From Austin, I'm Erica Aguilar for Marketplace.
Maybe you've noticed this where you live. In some places, just about everywhere you look, there's a billboard pitching the superior services of a particular hospital. Seems they're all spending more on those ads. As it turns out, a lot more. Hospital advertising on TV, radio, buses, and billboards now adds up to well over $1 billion a year. So what's all that money buying? The obvious answer is more patients, but Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports it goes further than that. Here's the story from our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia.
Standing on the soft shoulder of a freeway in Exton, Pennsylvania, across from a big box mall, nothing seems too special about the place. But for three nearby hospitals, this is disputed turf.
Yeah, well, we're in a very sort of hotly contested area here where three hospitals all claim this is part of their service area, where in fact it is.
Okay, now we're actually walking on the highway here, right? Or yes. On the main road?
Yeah, we are. And we're approaching a billboard that has an ad for the hospital where I work, the Chester County Hospital.
Richard Donzi is a doctor at Chester County.
He's got a big heart on it.
The billboard's for their cardiac care program. And on the other side of this billboard is another billboard for another hospital, advertising its joint and hip replacement program.
They've got their awards listed up there. We've got similar awards for hip replacement, knee replacement. We have the same things.
Chester County advertises those specialties on other billboards around town. There's a reason that hospital ads brag about one thing at a time.
The specialists at the Rothman Institute.
A specialized surgery or state-of-the-art technology.
CyberKnife and Gamma Knife technology.
It's not just to get your attention if you happen to need a joint replaced right now. It's to put in your mind that this would be the hospital to go to when and if you do need it. Because it turns out that what's in your mind has a whole lot to do with how much a hospital gets paid.
Insurance companies, how much they're willing to pay a hospital depends on how much their enrollees or their enrollees' employers want that hospital to be in their network.
Paul Ginsberg runs the Center for Studying Health System Change.
So in a sense, if they are perceived as very ordinary, replaceable hospital, they're not going to have much clout. On the other hand, if they are a hospital that consumers really want to have access to, the hospital has a very strong bargaining position. It says, look, you pay me this or I won't be in your network.
And a hospital can demand those higher reimbursements even if it has just one coveted specialty. Colin Drozdowski is a vice president for the insurance giant Anthem Wellpoint.
They are going to say, if you must have me for neonatal services or you must have me for cardiac services, then you're going to also have to pay for all of these other services at a premium.
It's sort of like when you go to a fancy restaurant for the food and they charge you $4 for a Diet Coke. A brand name hospital might be able to charge an insurance company twice as much for an MRI as another hospital down the street. A recent investigation by the Massachusetts Attorney General found that price difference has nothing to do with the quality of care. Again, here's Paul Ginsberg.
If there are no solid data that consumers trust that can really tell hospitals apart, well, then Madison Avenue will take over.
So if a hospital gets a top ranking, it can advertise that and attract better doctors, which leads to more awards and a stronger brand and even more leverage with insurers. Mike Dandorf is director of business development at the University of Pennsylvania's health system, which includes Penn Hospital.
Every business wants to be a must-have business, right? I mean, that's the essence of why we develop brands.
What would you give for a longer life?
Penn's ad campaign this year seems to embody its desire to ascend to that lucrative category known as the must-have.
When the only option is every option, your life is worth Penn Medicine.
This promise about your survival is what makes hospital advertising such a high-stakes game. Everyone wants the peace of mind that hospitals are selling. And hospitals know that the more they can make you love them, trust them, hope in them, the harder they can come down on your insurance company and make it pay. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, they come in multiple colors and look something like a rubber band in the shape of a horse or dragon or mermaid. They cost around $5 for a pack of 24, and the demand for silly bands is making a company in Toledo, Ohio, rich. Now the craze seems to be driving school administrators, well, silly. There are several published reports out this week that schools across the country are banning the bands to keep students from getting too distracted trading them in class. And to show just how big the latest fad among kids has become, Time Magazine reports this week that Macy's has been in touch with the company to see about including a silly bands float in its big Thanksgiving Day parade. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 122 points, 1 2/10%. The Nasdaq shaved off 20 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 fell 14 points, 1.25%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, pay what you want for a sandwich? Sounds simple enough.
The economic answer is pay nothing, but then they're trading that off against the perception of feeling cheap.
The price of peer pressure. I'm Bob Moon. We'll be back with this program on Monday. Hope you can join us then.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.